Case number 13-5139, Ivy Sports Medicine, LLC, Appellant v. Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services, in her official capacity at Elm. Mr. Hoffman for the Appellant, Mr. Jed for the Appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. In 2008, the director of FDA's Center for Devices, Dr. Daniel Schultz, made a valid and lawful determination that Regen's collagen scaffold device was substantially equivalent to other lawfully marketed surgical meshes and was therefore properly classified as a Class II device. And the question in this case is whether Dr. Schultz's successor, Dr. Jeffrey Schurin, had any authority to reconsider and rescind that initial classification decision almost 2 years later without complying with the substantive and procedural requirements for reclassification under Section 513 of the FDCA. And the answer under this court's decision in American Methyl, New Jersey, is no. The key holding of those cases is that when Congress has provided a statutory mechanism capable of rectifying mistaken actions, it is not reasonable to infer authority to reconsider agency action. In this case, FDA has conceded that it could have used Section 513E to reclassify the CS device. So by simple logic, under American Methyl in New Jersey, it's not proper to infer inherent reconsideration authority here. What FDA wants you to do is to carve out an exception to American Methyl, and that's not warranted in the facts of this case.
Well, or maybe the FDA position is that the statute here is a little bit different from the statute in American Methyl in terms of the way that it allocates the authority for a decision like Mr. Schurin's. The decision here that was made to allow the collagen scaffold to be marketed was a decision that was made without notice and comment rulemaking. Am I right?
The initial decision was made.
The substantial equivalence decision.
Yes, it was not a decision to allow marketing. It was a substantial equivalence decision, but it was made without notice and comment. Although the initial classifications of surgical meshes was done pursuant to a notice and comment rulemaking.
So we have here sort of two different tracks under FDA for approval of devices like this. One is the full dress notice and comment rulemaking that applied to all pre-amendment devices and is also available for post-amendment devices. But then we have this kind of this shortcut, the substantial equivalence determination. And so clearly the statute contemplates that reclassification of something that's been classified under the more full dress process would follow. Is it 360CE1?
Is that the provision?
But I guess the question is it really that clear that the statute contemplates that kind of full dress action in the agency's changing its mind on a substantial equivalence determination, in effect going back the shortcut rather than the long way?
Well, I guess I have several answers to that. I mean, one is I think what you have to recognize is that pre-amendment devices were initially classified by notice and comment rulemaking, and a substantial equivalence decision is essentially a decision that that a device is sufficiently similar to a lawfully marketed device that it fits within the contours of that regulation.
Right.
And that is why Congress initially provided for reclassification of pre-amendment devices by notice and comment rulemaking to parallel that original classification decision. FDA has always certainly taken the position that that 513E is the appropriate vehicle for reclassification of pre-amendment devices. They've done it many times in the past.
Of pre-amendment devices?
Well, devices that have been found substantially equivalent are treated as pre-amendment devices for regulatory purposes.
I'm sorry. Are you aware of any instances where the agency has utilized this 360CE authority to reclassify a device that was initially classified on a substantial equivalence determination? Is that something that they have a habit of doing?
I'm aware of circumstances where they've used, where they have used 513E to up-classify devices. I think in those instances, it's involved categories of devices that some of which didn't exist. For example, I mean, let me give you an example. The goniometers. This is not something that's in our brief, but you asked the question, so I'll. Those are devices that were originally described as AC powered devices. At some point, FDA made a decision that battery powered devices were substantially equivalent to AC devices, and then there was a reclassification that split the category such that certain battery powered and AC devices were in class two, and certain were in class one, and certain were in class two.
So this is sort of dealing with the whole typology, in a sense, the mapping of the universe on which then further substantial equivalence determinations are going to be made.
Right. That's right. And I mean, again, I think that it's important to recognize that there's no dispute here. FDA has not argued they could not have reclassified this under 513E. They didn't make that argument in the district court. They didn't make that argument here. I think if you look at page 39 of their brief, they concede they could have reclassified it. And
so is it your position that because they could have, that then that means that American Methyl expressio unius principle applies, that simply because they could, covers the waterfront?
I think that covers the waterfront with, American Methyl discusses a possible exception for cases of fraud, ex parte contacts, or other misconduct. I think the government's real argument here, the thrust of their argument, is that you should expand that exception to cover any kind of procedural flaw or substantive error, and I think that's inconsistent with what American Methyl says. I'm
not so sure. I mean, I think there are two steps to their argument. The first step is taking issue with your application of American Methyl to their situation. So, our statute isn't like that. This is not, the reclassification authority you're pointing to just doesn't have to do with substantial equivalence determinations, and so we didn't need to turn to that, And then even if we did, this is our argument under American Methyl footnote 51.
Right. Well, I mean, a couple of points to that. I mean, I think they do sort of argue that, well, the statutes are different. I think if you look at the statutory scheme that's discussed in American Methyl, the statutes are actually very, very parallel. I think it's important to recognize the agency did initially, when Dr. Shuren initially announced the preliminary report and said that they were going to reconsider it, what he said is, he was asked, what authority do you have to reconsider this? He said, what he said was, if necessary, we would move to reclassify the device. And he said, we just did that in the case of dental mercury. That was a reclassification under 513E. So the agency's initial position was that they were going to use 513E. Somewhere along the line, they changed their mind, and they've never given any explanation of why they chose to change their mind. Their position is, the statute says this, but we didn't have to follow the statute.
Can you help me out with the relationship between, I'm using the U.S. Code numbers, the relationship between 360CE1, which I take it to be 513, and 360CF3A, which provides that the Secretary may initiate reclassifications?
Sure. Yeah, F3A is the reclassification provision for not substantially equivalent Class 3 devices. So if a device is found to be not substantially equivalent and therefore classified into Class 3 under F1, then there is a procedure for reclassification of that device under 513 F3. So 513E is the reclassification for substantially equivalent devices. 513 F3 is the reclassification provision for post-amendment non-substantially equivalent devices. Well, I can get into de novo classification if you'd like, but I'm not sure that it's relevant here, since the agency said we wouldn't consider that.
What about the regulation 10.33 that allows reconsideration?
Yeah, well,
how does that fit into our thinking?
I think it doesn't, for a couple of reasons. Number one is 10.33 on its face allows the commissioner to reconsider a matter. The commissioner's authority under 10.33 has not been delegated down to the level of the center director. So Dr. Schurin didn't have authority to act under 10.33. But beyond that, I think the question really here is, has Congress created a mechanism for correction of mistakes? And there's no dispute here that they have. And if Congress has created that pathway and said this is how it should be done by statute, the agency can't create authority by regulation. So I don't think 10.33 can be read, so broadly as to allow the commissioner to exercise reconsideration authority in this circumstance. I mean, again, the agency can, they can play the sorcerer's apprentice, but not right. The sorcerer itself.
And then on inherent authority, let's suppose it got to that point and we didn't agree with your statutory argument about the displacement. You still have a within a reasonable time argument. Or do you?
I guess our argument is, I think under American Methyl, and
your first argument is the statute displaces the inherent authority. Let's put aside the footnote for now.
Yes, I mean.
And then I understand you'd have an alternative argument, but maybe I'm wrong, that even if you get to inherent authority, it has to be exercised within the appeal time or within a reasonable amount of time.
No, I think the position we've taken in our brief is that under Albertson and American Methyl, the agency has fairly broad reconsideration authority within the time period allowed for appeal. And that's that's clearly what Albertson says. American Methyl says once you get beyond that time for appeal, we're not going to consider whether there's any further inherent authority because, right. In this case, Congress has provided us a in our position is that this case is
like
American.
Let me ask it this way. Suppose if we disagreed with your argument that the statute displaced the inherent authority, if we disagreed with that, do you lose?
We have not raised the argument on appeal that our argument has been focused on American Methyl and the statutory.
Right. Okay. So, I thought you raised a time limit argument too, but
we raised a time limit argument in the district court. But our argument here has really been focused on American Methyl.
Okay.
There's an interesting
question. You go all in on American Methyl. That's right.
There's an interesting question as to how much time an agency should have to reconsider something. And we certainly would argue, we certainly did argue, and I think we continue to argue in our brief that, under any sort of short and reasonable time period standard, this was not short and reasonable.
I don't think we're quite all in on American Methyl
okay. In answer to your question, but I think we would say that this is not a short and reasonable time period. This was 22 months.
Now, what about the footnote that this fits within the footnote under some combination of ex parte misconduct? I don't think we've gotten a fraud allegation, but.
No, I would say there is no fraud allegation. The government has never alleged fraud. Mm-hmm. The district court did say that there was ex parte contact. That was an allegation that the government did not make in its briefs. And of course, there's no ex parte contact rules here. We addressed that in our brief. If you look through that preliminary report, which is really what the government relies on, and there are lots of reasons to be skeptical about that report, which I'm happy to get into, but there is no finding of misconduct by Region, by the commissioner, by Dr. Schultz. And to its credit, the government, I don't think, really asserts there was misconduct. What the preliminary report says is that there were procedural irregularities, there were departures from process. And what the government's trying to do here is to stretch those procedural irregularities into something akin to misconduct. I think misconduct connotes intentional wrongdoing.
You dispute whether there were irregularities, don't you?
We do dispute that there were irregularities. In fact, we think everything was done properly. The principal irregularities that are cited in the report If you look at the report, they address two questions.
So what are we supposed to do with the district court's conclusion that there were irregularities?
Well, this is a de novo review, so the district court's conclusion, I think, is erroneous.
But aren't they reviewing the agency record here, and the agency concluded that there were really serious reasons to be concerned with the solidity and the, you know, basically the effectiveness and safety of the devices? And so it's a little bit different from a cross motion for summary judgment outside the agency context, isn't it, in terms of how much of a fresh look we give to that kind of conclusion?
Well, I think you have to look at the statements in the preliminary report and give them appropriate weight as part of this conclusion. I think you have to look and see whether they are supported by the record. As I said, I think you have
but
to...
But we don't defer in that context to the agency's conclusions about what the report showed it.
I don't think you defer to litigation counsel's interpretation of the report, if that's what you're asking.
No, I think I'm asking about the agency's understanding of the report.
Right. Well, I mean, what I will say about the report is that the report, first of all, I think it's important to recognize this report was based largely on interviews with various FDA employees, which were not memorialized in any way. They were conducted by a staff attorney. One of the report's authors sat in on some of the interviews. The other two authors had no. Review of the report. And there are many things in the report that I think are factually contradicted by the record. So I think the court has to view the report with some skepticism. But let's take the report at face value. The report really addresses two questions.
Right. I don't really want to get into de novo analysis of the report. I'm really asking a question about whether and how we have to treat the agency's treatment of the report. But
yeah, my view is that you do not need to take everything in the report as a given, particularly if it's not supported by the remainder of the record, which in many cases it's not.
Can I just circle back and ask you again about these two different sort of reconsideration, reclassification provisions in the statute, and the one that you're relying on that starts based on new information respecting a device, the Secretary may on his own initiative or upon petition do this sort of change that it does with publishing in the Federal Register. And then there's this other one that you described as applying to post-amendment non-substantially equivalent devices. But doesn't it apply to post-amendment devices, whether they're not statutory equivalent or whether they are? Because it refers up to paragraph 1 of the section, which has both a device which is classified under substantial equivalence, that's A, or B, by... isn't this all about things that are reclassifications of devices that are found to be substantially equivalent? Isn't this really the provision you want to rely on or not?
No. The answer is, I think you're dealing with going to F1. F1A deals with something that's substantially equivalent to
right.
a pre-amendment device,
right.
and F2 F1B refers to something that's substantially equivalent to something that has been reclassified under Class 3. So F3 would allow you to do a substantial equivalent finding to a post-amendment device that was reclassified into Class 1 or Class 2.
Right. So what I'm saying is that F is about two different kinds of substantial equivalence determinations, right?
I mean, yes, although my understanding is that the agency largely focuses on A. I'm not sure to what extent they've used B.
Right. But so that's what that provision talks about. And then we have this provision... 360C F3A, which is a secretary-initiated reclassification provision that refers to determinations made under the subsection 1 that we were just looking at. And I'm just trying to understand, isn't that a non-notice and comment rulemaking way to reclassify that's in the statute that applies to devices that have been through a substantial equivalence process as distinct from
a
notice and comment rulemaking process?
I think the answer is 3A only applies to a device that is classified into Class 3 under paragraph 1. So that, by its nature...
Wait, they initiate the reclassification of a device, okay, classified into Class 3 under Paragraph 1.
So that would only apply to a device that's been classified into Class 3 under Paragraph 1, which would only occur if it is not substantially equivalent to a preeminent device.
Right, right.
I see my time is up, but I would like to briefly touch on the flaws in Dr. Sherman's decision. Just briefly, 513 I1E and the legislative history are very clear. The determination of intended use has to be based on the labeling. The claims made by the manufacturer are controlling. And in this case, the labeling makes very clear the intended use of the CS is repair and reinforcement, not replacement. Dr. Sherman relied on, reported to find some statement about replacement in the instructions for use. You can look at those at page JA934. There's nothing there about replacement. And I would also urge the court to look at page 1010 of the Joint Appendix, where there's a statement from an internal member from the review team, which makes it very clear that the review team was going beyond the labeling to look at intended use. It's also important to recognize that throughout this process, there were numerous...
Beyond the labeling and beyond the instructions and beyond the sort of... the contemplated sort of environment.
The quote is, Nancy, who's actually the person who conducted the interviews for the preliminary report, indicated that the review team looked at what the device is doing to determine intended use, but acknowledged we will be criticized for going beyond the labeling and looking at how the device is used in the study. The K98-1 guidance says intended use is based on labeling. And as I said, there's numerous experts looked at this, including the second panel, that concluded that the device did, in fact, repair and reinforce tissue. In that circumstance, it was certainly error for the court for Dr. Sherman, in those circumstances, to find the device, to use the device for replacement. I thank the court for its indulgence, and I'd like to hear what the FDA has to say.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Adam Jett for the FDA. May it please the court. It's common ground here that ordinarily when Congress confers authority on an administrative agency to make a decision, that implicitly Congress confers some degree of limited authority then to reconsider that decision. And the question before this court really is a narrow one. It's when FDA decided that a new medical implant was substantially equivalent to a set of predicates and therefore could piggyback off of those predicates, could be tethered to them and rely on their classification and rely on the special regulatory controls in place for them. And then if FDA decided that tether is no longer correct, whether FDA can just cut the tether or instead actually needs to conduct a full reclassification, which involves notice and comment rulemaking, input from expert panels, essentially...
I got a couple things here. First of all, Dr. Sherman says at the press conference, he's asked, what's the legal authority? What would you do? We would reclassify. So my question is, that was obviously the intent he had at that time. What happened? What's the practical problem with reclassifying?
So let me offer a couple of answers to your question.
Mm-hmm.
First, obviously, that was just a comment at a press conference. So, to be clear, I don't know.
Don't worry. I'm not relying on it as binding. It reflects an understanding, and I just am curious what would be the problem with reclassifying. You could have reclassified, correct?
So the answer is yes, but I do just want to be very clear about this because this is something that I think the plaintiffs have kind of painted over a little bit. Reclassifying, using this reclassification procedure that the plaintiffs are relying on, is different from cutting the tether.
I understand that.
Okay. It's not just that it involves a different analysis. I want to make very clear that when we cut the tether, the device is then just kind of out there in the ether, and then there's a question of what the appropriate classification for the device is. The default, if no one does anything about it, is Class 3. But obviously, as FDA made clear here...
It's a de facto reclassification, then, if the tether's cut and nothing's done.
If nothing is done, right. Yeah. I mean, it's hanging out there. As FDA made clear, they could have shown...
It's not hanging out there. It's in Classification 3,
it's
ultimately.
It's been reclassified.
Your Honor, I mean, it's reclassified as a matter of default. I mean, maybe here's sort of a different way that you might be able to look at it. Imagine, I understand that this is not exactly what the statute said, but imagine if the statute said if a device is not substantially equivalent, for 1 minute it will have no classification, and then after the expiration of that minute, then if no one has done anything, it ends up in Class 3 by default. It would appear that that kind of hypothetical statute would not square with any of plaintiff's argument, and I can't imagine that the existence of that 1 minute gap would essentially tell us whether Congress understood that you could rescind a substantial equivalence determination or not.
Can you do the practical? What was the practical problem? I just FDA here, I'm trying to get inside the mind of FDA. Why not do the reclassification?
Yeah, no, I understand. Obviously, I don't know the exact motivations of the decision maker, but I can tell you as a practical matter, the reclassification process that plaintiffs rely on is extremely resource intensive. I mean, it does involve notice and comment rulemaking. It does, or at this point, it can actually be promulgated.
And why do you think it's resource intensive?
Obviously, as this court knows more than any other court, the process of getting public notice and comment is an extremely elaborate
process. No, and it's resource-intensive to avoid mistakes.
Well, my understanding, I mean, you know, obviously this isn't a strict statutory requirement, but Your Honor asked about the practicalities. My understanding is that FDA uses that process ordinarily if it's dealing with whole groups of devices in much the same way that it uses the parallel processes for pre-76 devices and for new devices when it's looking at whole groups of devices.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Do you think FDA was concerned? Maybe they were concerned they didn't have the up classification authority at the time, although they asserted it. Your position is that they had it.
Again, as we indicated in our brief, the statute at the time did not expressly say that there was up classification authority. Mm-hmm. FDA's view was that it did confer up classification authority, but to my knowledge, that had not been adjudicated by a court, if that's your question.
So then my question is, you know, why make life complicated? American Methyl seems pretty, you can distinguish it, I get that, but the basic thrust of the case seems on point here, which is you could have done it through this procedure that allows you to make a change, and in light of that, we don't infer inherent authority. That just seems pretty commonsensical, so what's wrong with that?
We really think that American Methyl and New Jersey versus EPA, the other case that they rely on, are, I mean, really the opposite of this. I mean, what you have in both of those cases are two statutory provisions that are just two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. A statutory provision that says when, all new chemicals, when they come on the market, must be put in a list. And then you have a new section which says, to take any chemical off of that list, here's the process that you need to do. It relies on the exact same standard. It appears, I mean, just as a matter of plain text, particularly in the New Jersey case, that Congress was basically covering the entire scope of decisions that could be made. Obviously, in American Methyl, you also have the court looking at the legislative history and other structural clues to make sure that it's exclusive. Whereas here, although it may be correct that there were two different paths that the agency could have taken that ultimately may have led to the same result, and I'm highlighting may because, again, to be clear, it was an option available to the plaintiffs to have said, no, even though the default is Class 3, actually we're a Class 2. And I note that the only response that they put to that in their reply brief is they say that FDA indicated to them that that wouldn't be appropriate for their particular device. But, I mean, that's just as a sort of factual matter, based on the particular facts of this device, it appeared that they wouldn't be able to show that it is Class 2, but FDA still offered them the option. And obviously, the tail can't wag the dog, right? I mean, obviously, the facts of this particular case can't determine the interpretation of the statute. These are not two sides of the same coin at all. They're different procedures that rely on different standards that sometimes get to the same endpoint and sometimes do not.
What I'm struggling with, however, is you used the phrase plain text. What is there about E1 that doesn't cover this circumstance?
I mean, Your Honor, E1 specifically says that FDA can reclassify, that it can go through a process in which it determines whether something meets the statutory requirements of 1, 2, or 3.
So far, we're on this case, right?
We're not on this case, Your Honor. When FDA rescinds the substantial equivalence determination, FDA is not deciding whether this meets the statutory classification of 1, 2, or 3. FDA is just cutting the tether. It's just saying you can no longer piggyback off of a device that's already on the market, or in this case, off of approximately a dozen devices that are already on the market. That's all that it's saying. Now, I understand plaintiff's argument is that they end up as a Class 3 if they do nothing. That is just a matter of default. But by cutting the tether, FDA is not determining whether it meets 1, 2, or 3. If you look at the statutory provision that my friends are relying on, CE, that's a provision which says if FDA is going to take a device and say that that device, you know, is currently classified as 2, for example, and meets the classification standards of 3, that then FDA has to go through a particular...
So your argument turns on this imagery of cutting the tether and letting it go in the ether, right? That sounds sort of metaphysical.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that it depends on the imagery. I just think it's sort of a helpful way to understand why it is that these two are different. Conversely,
they're different. They're different, but if you reclassify, it encompasses the substantial equivalence determination in the sense that you would reclassify because you found that it's not substantially equivalent.
Well, again, Your Honor,
And maybe other things as well, but it encompasses the substantial equivalence determination as well.
Again, Your Honor, I mean, perhaps we're just talking past each other, but I think that's actually incorrect. In a reclassification,
Let me play this out. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
Let me just make... So you think it's substantially equivalent, let's say, and then the agency says, wait a second, maybe not substantially equivalent, and it was classified as classification two. And now we think, no, it's not substantially equivalent and may have to therefore fall into classification three. You would propose to therefore reclassify.
I think that...
What's wrong with that?
I think that Your Honor is actually sort of pulling together the two strands in that question that are actually separate. The agency could, in theory, think, gosh, here's a device that previously came on the market because it was determined to be substantially equivalent. They could just think, it doesn't appear that this thing is substantially equivalent. That was a mistake. In fact, they might think it stays as the same classification. You could have a device which came on the market.
But they'd have to do something to keep it at, to say it's not substantially equivalent and keep it at the same classification, they would have to.
They would cut the tether.
Right.
And then there's just a question of what is the appropriate classification. And in fact, the appropriate classification might be the same one that it already had. It might be that that previously class 2 device, in fact, should stay as a class 2 device.
Do you know of any instances where that's happened?
As I think my friend was getting to, the FDA hardly ever uses this reclassification procedure for any single device, only for groups of devices. FDA has rescinded substantial equivalence determinations. I think the number is approximately 50 of them in the history of the program. I don't know, with respect to those 50, how many of them then ended up being classified in the same classification.
But when they exercised that authority, or they chose, I mean, your metaphor is the tether, or you take piggyback,
sure.
Or I was thinking there's this shortcut that they can take. When they take back that decision that you can use the shortcut or that the tether puts it there, how many of those determinations were done by notice and comment rulemaking? Were they all?
The cutting the tether is just a decision that it's not substantially equivalent, but is not done by notice and comment rulemaking.
That's never done by notice and comment.
Notice and comment rulemaking is separate. Notice and comment rulemaking is actually for a classification decision. Your Honor, I completely understand. Obviously, there is some sort of terminology confusion here.
Right. And so my understanding is that the agency allows a kind of piggybacking classification decision via substantial equivalence, and that your assertion is that many times the agency has said, get off the piggyback, we got to look at this in a different way. And then they've turned around and in some cases, through a notice and comment rulemaking process, been classified as one or two, and in other cases not.
As to the sort of last factual premise of your question, whether after they've caught the tether, avoided the shortcut, or whatever terminology Your Honor wants to use, I don't know whether or sort of in what percentage of cases that reclassification has then sort of put it back into the same class that initially was, but sort of on its own merits rather than piggybacked or tethered to another device. And what I should add, Your Honor, by the way, just maybe a different way to kind of conceptualize this difference, as we point out, device could be substantially equivalent to another Class 3 device. In other words, a substantial equivalence decision doesn't necessarily even determine its classification. As we point out, I mean, the way that the statute is set up, there's a large number of pre-76 devices for which the manufacturers don't even need pre-market approval until there's been a call for it. A new device can come on the market and say that it's substantially equivalent to that, and it's still in Class 3.
Let me back up. You said there are about 50 instances where the tether has been cut. Have any of those been challenged or any of those challenged?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but I don't know the complete universe of those.
Now, suppose we're in inherent authority land. We have another strand of precedent on the time limit. And, you know, we got to follow that. So what's your response to that?
Let me give you the doctrinal response and the theoretical response. Mm-hmm. First of all, just doctrinally, I think plaintiffs are actually just grossly misreading the cases. So plaintiffs are relying heavily on Albertson. They also rely on American Methyl for their timing point. I actually think American Methyl is helpful to us. If I could just walk Your Honor briefly through a couple of these cases.
You can do it at length.
Your Honor, Albertson in 1950 is the first case that uses the within appeal time language that the plaintiffs are pointing to. Now, in Albertson, the question was actually just whether a petition for reconsideration told the time for taking an appeal. And if Your Honor just focuses on that language in Albertson, we think when it uses that within appeal time language, it's because it's explaining why it is that that would therefore toll the appeal. If you acted out of the appeal time, then obviously their appeal would have been untimely. And so the tolling question would just be irrelevant. And we think if you look actually at this court's later decision from the 70s in Spanish International, it describes Albertson in that sense, that the question in Albertson and Spanish International then are just the applicable FCC, both regs for when you can get reconsideration and statute for how long you have to take an appeal. Mm-hmm. If you look at the National Association of Trailer...
You were going to mention American Methyl.
I was. Your Honor, I actually think American Methyl is helpful to us.
Right.
The passing comment that it makes about appeal time is actually dictum, but if Your Honor looks at that very sentence on page 835...
That's always a scary first start, by the way.
Your Honor, if you look at that sentence on page 835, mm-hmm. it says that the time to appeal has passed. Now, if the rule is what plaintiffs actually seem to have just disclaimed at the podium but have previously suggested it is, which is that you can only rescind a determination within the appeal time, then it means that
we upheld that agencies have an inherent power to correct their mistakes by reconsidering their decisions within the time period available for taking an appeal.
I apologize. It may be the next sentence where it then says that the time period for taking
that period is long expired here.
If the rule is what plaintiffs advocated in district court and seem to have abandoned here, that the power goes away after you can't take an appeal, then those two sentences were the only sentences that were necessary to American Methyl. But obviously, the court in American Methyl took great pains to analyze the interaction of the two different statutes.
Right. They didn't want to. That's a good point, because they go on to say we need not consider what might exist after the appeal time's run because we have the statutory displacement. That's a good point.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I could just point Your Honor to the
But you agree it's within a reasonable time, then?
We do agree that the standard is within a reasonable
time. How should we figure that out?
That's the standard that we think this court adopted in National Association of Trailer Owners and every other court has adopted. I'll explain how you figure it out, but I do just want to step back and just make one observation, which is that the district court held that this decision was made within a reasonable period of time. Plaintiffs did not challenge that in their opening brief. In fact, the only time that plaintiffs have actually argued that this was not within a reasonable period of time is in a footnote in the reply brief. And there is a lot of developed law on that, so it's actually somewhat prejudicial that we really haven't had an opportunity to brief that. But if Your Honor is just sort of interested in understanding how it is that that normally works, the Sixth Circuit's Belleville decision does a nice job in just summarizing the case law from various circuits
right.
on how courts determine what is a reasonable period of time. Obviously, courts look at how much time had elapsed. Courts look at questions such as the complexity of the decision. They look at questions such as how much reliance has occurred, whether the agency acted reasonably, whether the agency acted in bad faith. And I want to point out that if you just sort of think about those factors, which are actually quite intuitive, I think those factors also go to show why it is that plaintiff's 30-day standard would frankly just be silly, which is that this is a really complicated decision. I mean, what happened here was soon after FDA made a decision, there were accusations of impropriety. FDA didn't just pull the trigger and rescind the decision. They instead said, look, these are serious accusations. Let's look into it. And they did a very serious job looking into it. I mean, you know, they put together a high-level team. They interviewed FDA officials. They conducted document reviews.
Well, the serious accusations were political pressure saying that the decision was influenced by political pressure.
Accusations were also about the agency's responsiveness. There were suggestions that the agency had given way in the makeup of the panel. There were suggestions, which actually did turn out to be or accurate, that the final agency decision didn't really explain the final agency decision or address some of the concerns that had been raised below. And when FDA completed that real preliminary report and decided, you know, there's just no way to know exactly what happened here. The decision hasn't properly been explained. There are real questions. Again, at that point, potentially FDA could have just rescinded the decision, but it didn't. It took more time, and it said we're going to leave the substantial equivalence decision in place while we conduct a careful scientific reevaluation. It did that first by bringing in a new core team. Again, that's a slower process, but it's a process that protects the rights of the plaintiffs who themselves had leveled a number of accusations against actually
that's
several
what
different
don't
teams.
Get, now I'm circling back to my first question. I just don't get why you didn't go through the full process that Dr. Shuren describes.
I mean, you know, again, Your Honor,
because you're saying you wanted to protect the plaintiff's interests, which I that's good, but there was a process to do so even more thoroughly, I guess.
Yeah, again, Your Honor, I mean, you know, I don't know the exact motivations.
Right.
I can tell Your Honor, just as a policy matter, that ordinarily that full reclassification process is extremely burdensome. My understanding is that
that's
it
fair.
Is more burdensome than, you know, putting together a new review team here, but obviously I don't have statistics about that. When the new review team finishes its conclusion, again, they could have just rescinded the decision, but instead they bring in a panel of outside experts because that's what it is that had potentially sort of changed the decision in plaintiff's favor before. And then at the end of that, they offer to the plaintiffs a regulatory hearing. Plaintiffs ask for an extension about whether to request a regulatory hearing. They wait several more months. I mean, it appears that this obviously just, you know, as a matter of calendar days, this took a fair amount of time. But this took a fair amount of time because it was an extremely complex decision and because it was a reconsideration process that was really meant to protect the rights of the plaintiffs here.
So is safety and equivalence figuring into this, either on the way into substantial equivalence or on the way out? Or is it just assumed both ways?
I'm not sure if I understand Your Honor's question.
Is part of the concern that this device may not, in fact, be safe, and that's why the agency is motivated to take it off the market?
I think it's fair to say that there were some concerns of safety and actually more of efficacy. I mean, there was sort of some dispute in the record as to whether there were safety concerns, and although we haven't really addressed this in the brief, it turns out essentially the device sort of in and of itself and the way that a sort of doctor would think about it was not particularly unsafe, but there were a large number of adverse events as compared to sort of alternate treatments. But the main concern was effectiveness, and indeed that's a concern that I think was acknowledged basically all the way up. There was no valid scientific data to support that this device did anything that was effective at all. The only study that
But just on safety, FDA never justified its decision based on conclusion that it was unsafe, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, yeah. FDA found that the statutory requirements for substantial equivalence had not been met, that when it allowed this device to be tethered to a new device because it met two statutory requirements, that was an error, and it really didn't meet those two statutory requirements, and therefore it couldn't be tethered.
So suppose American Methyl applies. What's your best footnote 51 argument?
So our understanding of footnote 51, and, you know, obviously this court is the prime interpreter of its own decisions, and conceivably footnote 51
Help
is,
me out.
Is far from clear. But our understanding of footnote 51 is we focus on the language at the end of that sentence where it says misconduct tainting the original record. And
what do you think misconduct is?
So
can't just be that we got it wrong.
I look at misconduct, and my understanding is that if you look back at the prior decision and you look at the processes that were used to make that decision, that just things didn't go right. The proper rules weren't followed, and there's just the reason that you reconsider.
That would apply in every case where you made an error. So it would wouldn't that swallow the general rule in American Methyl? In other words, we think we got it wrong last time, therefore it was misconduct, therefore.
It wouldn't, Your Honor. I apologize if I'm being unclear. Let me put this somewhat differently, which is that sometimes you can just go back and look at a past decision, and without reevaluating the substance of it, you could say, you know, basically everyone did everything right. And by right, I don't mean sort of substantively right. I just mean, you know, they kind of checked the right boxes. They thought about the right things. They discussed the right factors. Now, once you've sort of said all of that, it is still always possible that you might reevaluate the science and come at a different way. But just as a matter of procedure, it looks like everything was right. The problem here, and I think this is what we understand, the misconduct tainting the original record language to be getting at, is that when you looked back at that prior decision, there was really just no way to know what had happened. I mean, there had been unusual contacts.
Let me stop you there. What was unusual?
So my understanding is it was both the pressure of the contacts. If you look at, for example, JA-818.
Is it just the members of Congress? That's not unusual. It's very common.
Well, Your Honor, obviously the fact that Congress is sometimes in contact with FDA is one thing. What we had here was sort of an amalgamation of different things, which is a tremendous amount of external pressure from Congress, a tremendous amount of external pressure from the manufacturer, and most importantly, a tremendous amount of response. I think that one of the people who was interviewed described it as acquiescence of the kind that he had never seen. And then you look at all of that, and then you look at the final decision. And in the final decision, you still have every FDA staffer on the way up saying that this is not substantially equivalent. Until you get to the head of ODE.
So Dr. Schultz engaged in misconduct?
Your Honor, obviously, there's no evidence that Dr. Schultz violated.
You have to find it somewhere. Where is it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You have to find this misconduct somewhere.
There has to be a person who engaged in misconduct.
Your Honor, just misconduct is sort of a loaded word, so I'm just trying to be careful.
Exactly, but that's the problem with it. It's a loaded word, but it was the word used in footnote 51 and shouldn't be cavalierly thrown around, but you're saying it applies here, so who engaged in misconduct?
Well, so if Your Honors would understand this as misconduct, I would say that Dr. Schultz's final decision gives two reasons for the decision. One of them is he just points to the decision of a subordinate who in turn had said that her decision was based on the judgment that Dr. Schultz had already formed. And two, he then just says that the outside panel of experts had unanimously found that the device is safe and effective. And although there can certainly be argument about to what extent they thought it was effective, it was by no means unanimous. And then Dr. Schultz's final decision didn't address any of the serious concerns that had been raised by the FDA staffers. If you have a decision which actually explains why it is that it reached the decision that it did and addresses the relevant concerns, I mean, you know, maybe not perfectly and thoroughly, but at least in some way that you sort of understand the basis for the decision, then even if later you think it was wrong, you kind of understood what happened there. Whereas here, I mean, I think the real question is just what it is that motivated FDA's decision to reconsider. FDA looked at this earlier decision, including Dr. Schultz's final decision, and there was just no way to know exactly what it is that had led to this final result. And I mean, Dr. Schultz's job, particularly if he was reversing everyone beneath him, was to say what had led to that final result. And, you know, again, conceitedly, footnote 51 is not particularly clear, but our understanding is that that is what it's getting at.
Mr. Jeff, what do you make of Mr. Hoffman's point that the agency really was applying the wrong standard, wasn't limiting its consideration to the label, the information on the label? You know, they were all over the map on that, the agency.
I think that is incorrect. He makes a couple of sort of specific arguments. Let me just, before I delve into them, just step back and make two observations. One is that a number of the parts of the record that my friend points to, and indeed was actually just talking about at the podium, are about earlier decisions and recommendations and not the actual final decision that is under review in this court. And second is, if you just step back and think about what the standard is for substantial equivalence, this is well accepted. I think the plaintiffs agree. You can find this in this court's Sartori decision and the FDA guidance documents. What you do is you start by looking at whether the new device has the same or different indications for use. Indications for use are the place it's going to be used, how it's going to be inserted, that sort of thing. And again, I think everyone agrees, as Dr. Schern's decision spelled out, that there are new indications for use here. He identified two of them. One is that, unlike any of the predicates, this device is being inserted into the intra-articular joint space. And two, unlike any of the predicates, this device was inserted by removing all unhealthy tissue. And at that point, there's just a question of whether those differences in indication for use constitute a new intended use. And again, I think this is well accepted. I believe this is the premise of the Sartori decision. You can see this in the FDA guidance documents. You then ask whether, as a result of those different indications for use, whether the new device then has a different therapeutic effect or raises new questions of safety or efficacy. And the plaintiffs don't address any of that. Instead, essentially, they just say that on their label, they said that this repairs and does not replace, as if that's the end of the story. But the FDA's final decision relied on other things that were on the label. FDA didn't go outside of the label. It knows that this device goes into the intra-articular joint space because that's in the instructions that are part of the labeling. It knows that you remove all unhealthy tissue because that's in the instructions that are in part of the labeling. And you can't just deem away a difference. I mean, if you look at, for example, the Sartori case, there you had a device that was quite similar to a previous device but was being used on fat rather than blood. You can't just say on your label, this device operates the same way on fat as the predicate devices operate on blood, and therefore just deem away the potential differences. Instead, FDA actually has to look at the differences in indication. Then at that point, what Dr. Schern explained is he said, look, this does raise new questions. In the intra-articular joint space, this is going to be bearing serious forces, and he kind of explains the various kinds of forces to a level of scientific detail that I don't particularly understand. He explains that by removing all of the unhealthy tissue and then putting this in where the unhealthy tissue was, where it will then have to bear the forces that were previously borne by the unhealthy tissue, it's replacing that unhealthy tissue. Now, the plaintiffs kind of quibble about this difference between replace and repair slash reinforce. I mean, I do just want to say, explaining this as replacement, I think just quite colloquially, is easy to understand. If you take something out and you put something back in where it will bear some of the same forces, it's replacing that. Before the agency, I think the only response the plaintiffs gave is they said, well, eventually new human tissue will grow in. And as Dr. Shuren said, one, there were questions as to how long that would take, what the structure of the new tissue would be in light of the device. And in some sense, you're still replacing the old tissue through the sort of process of setting up this framework into which new tissue will grow. But I do just want to say kind of...
Although don't they point to the precedent of the fistular mesh that there's a similar... And always when you're doing surgery, you clear away the site. So,
I mean, there's a difference between, you know, maybe kind of clearing away a site and actually removing something for the purposes of putting something in. I mean, if Your Honor kind of looks at Dr. Shuren's decision, he actually discusses some of the predicates. And, I mean, just step back and understand how different some of these predicates are. For example, the shoulder device that he discusses, which is, by the way, the only device that's even remotely used in some kind of a joint space, there, essentially, what's happening are...
It's covering the stitches.
Right, exactly. The stitches are bearing the forces. You have ligaments, you're pulling them together, you're sewing it up. You're actually using suture anchors in that as well. It's a covering. I mean, you know, it's obviously, you know, it may bear some, you know, kind of Newton of force there, but it's not actually kind of in the middle of the joint bearing the load. And terminology aside, I mean, you know, kind of just separate and aside from this exact word choice between repair versus reinforce versus replace, they've never explained why it is that these differences in indications in use don't constitute a new intended use, other than just pointing back to the label and saying that they basically just deemed the answer in advance.
One final point on the misconduct, if I could again. We often, as we're wont to say, an agency didn't engage in reasoned decision-making, didn't follow a procedure, et cetera, and vacate an agency decision, but we wouldn't usually equate that with misconduct.
Again, I mean, you know, obviously this court is the best interpreter of that footnote.
Yeah.
If you look at both the case law that has fleshed out the sort of notion of implicit authority and some of the early sources on which that case law is built, courts have often said, look, generally an agency has a certain degree of power to reconsider. And then it's sort of separately said, but the real core, the real thing that you're worried about is if things went wrong. And not just wrong in result, not just later on you think the answer was A and the answer was not B, but rather the way that the decision should have been made was not the way that the decision was made.
But sometimes we really blister an agency, and still the word misconduct, and I'm just...
The high threshold.
Yeah, I mean, it's misconduct, and you said this earlier, and I think it's right, and I take your point, and you're right, we're going to have to figure out, right, if we get to that, what that means, but it does seem like a loaded term that is not cavalierly thrown around.
Yeah, I mean, just to put this a little bit differently, I understand that footnote in the context of the American Methyl decision, where, and again, you know, as we've explained, we think American Methyl is very different. It's kind of two sides of the same coin. But in the American Methyl decision, really what they're saying is, look, you got a bunch of new information in, you want to essentially do the exact same thing this kind of provision of the statute allows you to do. It's not that you're really doubting your earlier decision. I mean, that's what American Methyl was about. Mm-hmm. And what I understand that footnote to say, and I think this draws on a lot of the history of this doctrine, is that even in that scenario, still you might look differently when you have a prior decision that there's really just no way to know whether it got it right. Certainly the procedures that were followed were not the normal procedures that were followed. Mm-hmm. Certainly the reason that was given in the decision is not one that actually explains the decision. Okay. And there's at least a real prima facie question as to whether they got it right. Doesn't it make sense for the agency at least just to take another look and do the science again and see if it was right or wrong?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jed. We'll give you back 5 minutes. How's that? Okay.
Thank you. Okay. That's very generous. So a couple of points. I think, first of all, I think I heard Mr. Jed say fairly clearly that the agency could have used 513E, and when asked why they didn't, I think the answer that we got was, well, it was sort of too burdensome or cumbersome. It's not what we usually do for individual devices. I think, first of all, I don't think that even if it were unduly burdensome, I don't think that would be a justification for not following the statute.
What do you make of his argument that reclassification was not what was going on here? This is something else that shouldn't be called.
It's exactly what was going on here. You had one person who decided that this should be a Class 2 device applying the substantial equivalence standard.
Respond to this tethering image, this idea.
Yeah, I mean, I must say, I'm sort of puzzled by the tethering image. you know, substantial equivalence is the standard that is used for classification, and I think that F1 and 3 are, in fact, mirror images of each other. That is, one deals with initial classification of devices, and the other deals with reclassification of devices. And
well, can one make the substantial equivalence analysis and not end up with reclassification?
Could one? I'm not sure I understand the question.
Because I understood he was saying there may be a separate inquiry here. That
I think what he was saying is that there are categories of Class 3 devices for which FDA has not promulgated a PMA requirement. And so if a device is found to be substantially equivalent to a pre-amendment Class 3 device for which there's no PMA requirement, then the new device has no PMA requirement, which just reflects the fact that once that device is found to be substantially equivalent, it's placed in the same bucket and is treated the same way for regulatory purposes as the predicates. And, of course, if FDA decides that it shouldn't have been placed in that bucket, you know, it wasn't substantially equivalent, or there's a particular subcategory of that class that imposes special differences, they can go back and reclassify under Section 513E.
It just doesn't make sense to me that you would have a statutory regime that would allow the substantial equivalence determination to be made without notice and comment, and that would require, in order to unmake it, that you use the notice and comment process. I just find it really hard to read the statute that way.
Well, I mean, number one, I think that's consistent with the way that FDA has read the statute, but let me suggest that part of the reason for that is that once FDA has determined that a device has an initial classification of a device, there is a finality interest, and the manufacturer of that device and manufacturers of other devices are entitled to rely on that. And if the agency is going to change that decision, it has an impact not only on that individual device, but on other devices as well, which is why notice and comment rulemaking is appropriate.
Well, that's true, but there's also a big interest on the part of the public and the medical profession that a substantial equivalence determination be really sound, and that we're not, you know, they talk about, you know, in the record, some of this problem with the creep when you're substantial equivalence daisy chain on. You know, there are some concerns at the front end too, but the statute has said, you know, we're gonna shortcut here, we're gonna tether here, and so I'm not sure why we should weigh the reliance interests of the industry more heavily. I mean, I don't see anything in the statute that indicates that it meant to make.
Well, I guess I respectfully disagree. I think the statute is very clear that that the means for reclassification is Section 513. I think that's the position the agency has consistently taken. The agency, you know, recently changes were made to change this from a notice and comment to an order that's also sort of notice and comment. So there, you know, the agency has made changes to it. That, you know, that's the way that the agency's always interpreted the statute. I do want to address Mr. Jett's comments about in response to the misconduct point, because I think what I heard him say when asked what the misconduct was is that really Dr. Schultz didn't adequately explain his reasoning. Now, I don't agree with that. I think there is a substantial record supporting Dr. Schultz's decision, including the panel transcript. But even if you buy that is not misconduct. That is a classic, you know, we might have gotten it wrong error, which is exactly the kind of thing that's at issue in American Methyl. If you go back to his cut the tether image, that's exactly what the agency was trying to do in American Methyl. They were saying, you know what, we think on further reflection, we might have gotten this wrong. So rather than going through the statute, we are going to redo it and just cut out, you know, undo our original decision. And, you know, for the same reasons that it wasn't permissible in American Methyl, it's not permissible here. Just briefly on the repair and reclassification, the repair and reinforcement issue, I think that the issue here is that when you take out a portion of the meniscus and you put something in, the question is that device intended to serve the function of the functions of what was replaced, or is it intended to repair and reinforce what's left? And the claim that is made in the labeling is solely that it's intended to repair and reinforce what is left. Throughout the process, Dr. Tillman, who was the director of ODE, understood that this was intended as a replacement device. That's what the indication said. Dr. Skinner, who reviewed the device for FDA, said that, in my opinion, the clinical data in the 510K support the proposed indication for Regency S as a repair or reinforcement, but it wouldn't support a replacement indication. That's at page 1370 of the Joint Appendix. And, of course, the second panel, when asked repeatedly if the device repaired and reinforced tissue, said, yes, it does repair and reinforce tissue. So, you know, the agency certainly can ask whether the device is performing a repair and reinforce function, but they can't say that when the labeling says it's to repair and reinforce, do not use it for replacement, when there's an express contraindication, they can't say, they can't ignore that. I don't think they can deem that away, to use Mr. Chet's phrase.
And what about the sort of in the articular joint concern that was also raised in the record, that it's a little bit different to lie a mesh over an area and have a salutary benefit and to put it into a weight-bearing area within the joint?
Right. Well, of course, meshes are used in different anatomical areas, and they may, there may be differences in particular anatomical areas, but that doesn't mean that there is a new intended use. In each case, the question is, does it serve to repair and reinforce soft tissue or bone? And, I mean, that's the question, that's the level of generality that FDA looks at. They don't look at the specific anatomical site. So the question really is, does it repair and reinforce soft tissue? And the answer is it does. And the panel found that it does. And so Dr. Schering, ignoring what Dr. Tillman had done and, not really giving any weight to the panel's finding, started off by saying, no, it's really a replacement. And then everything else in his decision is infected by that, because it's all based on the erroneous assumption that the device is intended to serve the function of meniscus. That's not what it's intended to do. I hesitate to use analogies to drugs, but if you have a drug and it may be used, it's intended for use for one purpose, but it may have some other purpose, and the manufacturer says in the indication statement, do not use it for this purpose. People understand that it's not going to be used for that purpose, and this is really what we have here.
Baby aspirin is for the pain relief of babies, not for the cardiac health of old people. By now, it's probably both.
With that, unless the court has other questions, I thank you for your consideration. We'd ask that the decision be reversed and ordered to the side.
Thank you, and thank both of you for excellent arguments.
Really well argued case.
Case is submitted.